CBS News presents Edward R. Murrow with the news. Mr. Murrow is heard Monday through Friday at this time with his report and analysis of the latest news developments. In his summary of the news and in his analysis of its meaning, Mr. Murrow frequently uses the exclusive reports of CBS News correspondents in this country and overseas. By shortwave radio, by telegraph and cable, from news centers around the world, their on-the-spot reports provide first-hand coverage of the news as it happens. Each of these correspondents is a specialist, with a specialist knowledge of the country to which he has been assigned, and each of them makes a point of reporting the often unpublicized, behind-the-scene events that give added significance to the news of the day. From their reports, you learn not only what is happening, but why it is happening. The result is the complete authoritative coverage for which CBS News is noted. Tonight, there will be a direct report from Warsaw on the parliamentary election Poland will hold on Sunday. Now, here is Edward R. Murrow.
This is the news. Three B-52 bombers landed at March Air Force Base in California today, completing the first non-stop jet flight around the world. The stratojets were refueled in the air and made the 24,000-mile flight in the unofficial time of 45 hours and 19 minutes. That's an average speed of better than 500 miles an hour. Five B-52s made up the original formation, but two dropped out. The flight was led by Major General Archie J. Old, Jr., commander of the 15th Air Force, and General Kurt LeMay of the Strategic Air Command decorated each of the 27 crewmen with a Distinguished Flying Cross. General LeMay called the flight a demonstration of the capabilities of SAC to strike any target on the face of the earth. He said a simulated nuclear bomb drop had been made by the aircraft at a point roughly halfway around the world, south of the Malay Peninsula. In Washington today, a federal judge sentenced Mrs. Mary Knowles of Plymouth Meeting, Pennsylvania, to serve 120 days in jail for contempt of Congress. She was also fined $500. Mrs. Knowles is a librarian, employed at a library operated by the Quakers at Plymouth Meeting. She refused in 1955 to tell the Senate Internal Security Subcommittee whether she had ever been a communist. Judge Risley of the United States District Court allowed Mrs. Knowles to post bond pending an appeal. In another case, Judge Risley today convicted Robert Shelton, a New York Times copy reader, of contempt of Congress. Shelton had also refused to tell the Senate committee whether he was a communist. Both he and Mrs. Knowles based their refusal to answer on the guarantees of free speech and press under the First Amendment. The executive vice president of the Teamsters Union, Einar Mohn, today refused to testify before the Senate committee investigating labor racketeering. Mohn contended that the committee lacks proper authority to investigate union matters, that it was set up to investigate government operations. Committee Chairman McClellan complained that Teamsters President Dave Beck failed to show up at today's hearing as promised. Beck sent a telegram saying he could not come because he was ill. The United Nations General Assembly today continued its debate on the withdrawal of Israeli troops from Egypt. Israel has demanded assurance that if it pulls out of the region commanding the Gulf of Aqaba and the Gaza Strip, Egyptian forces will not move in to harass Israel. The United States has proposed that United Nations troops occupy those areas pending a settlement. So has Australia. Today, Britain proposed that the United Nations internationalize the Gaza Strip, and Canada suggested that UN forces be deployed along a line stretching from the Gulf of Aqaba to the Mediterranean to prevent border incidents. The Associated Press reports from Cairo that Egypt, Saudi Arabia, and Syria are willing to offer Jordan $36 million a year to take the place of the annual subsidy Jordan has been receiving from Great Britain. In Moscow today, Soviet Premier Bulganin and Chinese Communist Premier Zhou Enlai signed a communique culminating their talks. The communique said the governments of the Soviet Union and the Chinese People's Republic resolutely condemn the United States program for the Middle East. The communique promises the Middle East countries that Russia and Red China will give them any support necessary to resist what they call the colonial policies of the Washington administration. It promises any support necessary in order to avert aggression and interference in the affairs of the countries of that region. Immediately after the communique was issued, Zhou Enlai left Moscow for Afghanistan. The Hungarian government has ordered the British military attaché in Budapest out of the country. He is charged, according to Radio Budapest, with taking an active part in the November revolt in that country. On Sunday, Poland will hold a parliamentary election of a sort, and the Russians have taken precautions lest it should set off an uprising in East Germany. My colleague Ernest Leiser cables me from Bonn that for the time being, the East Germans are prohibited from holding any large public meetings of any kind. He says further that border police have been ordered to tighten their controls. And he reports, too, that a considerable part of Russia's armed forces in East Germany have been placed on alert. Leiser based his report on intelligence sources in Berlin. My colleague Daniel Shore, whose base of operations is in Moscow, has gone to Warsaw to cover the Polish elections. For a report on how the campaign is going, we switch now to Daniel Shore in Warsaw.
Tonight, loudspeaker trucks are roaming through the cold mist of Warsaw, blaring appeals to turn out Sunday and vote the full National Front ticket. Over Lodz, planes dropping leaflets with similar appeals. In Warsaw alone, 100 election rallies held. Everywhere, billboards plastered with signs headed by a big red 20, reminding the voters of January 20th, day of the parliamentary elections. The same in newspapers and on radio. The campaign of Gomulka's three-party National Front has a tone of urgency, of pleading, that seems weird on the surface. For there is no other party campaigning, no equal time for anybody on radio, and the communists would seem to be tilting with windmills, like the loudspeakers shouting into the mist. In a district that can send 6 deputies to parliament, there's a single ballot with 10 names. Vote the whole list and you vote for the top 6. Cross out a few names and you'll be voting for other communists or frontists further down the list. How can they lose? And so what's all the shouting about? Yet there is a reason for the urgency, 2 reasons. One is that the voter, fed up with communist rule, may protest by staying home. Or he may go to the polls and, in his yearning for a change, may give his vote to those at the bottom of the list, the new faces, the young people known to be anti-Russian or only lukewarm communists. And thus he could oust the top communists and change the complexion of the party. This, the party leadership warns, would be a disaster. It might arouse the Russians. One voter said, "I'll vote the party list because I don't want Warsaw to be another Budapest." The fear of the Russians is one of Gomulka's most potent arguments. Another is fear of the Germans, the fear of losing the valuable Silesian industrial basin annexed from Germany after the war. At a rally the other night in a school auditorium, in a workers' quarter rebuilt from the old ghetto, I heard a party official get a big hand when he said, "For the first time in centuries, Poland has friendly relations with all her neighbors, that is, with Russia, East Germany, and Czechoslovakia." Poland is sick of being a battleground for Russians and Germans, and Gomulka promises peace. If the Poles thought they could be rid of the Russians, they would vote for this. But they're being warned that voting against Russia might invite Russian intervention. If they could vote for a return to capitalism, many might do that. But they are warned that a vote against communism might only bring a worse form of communism. If they could vote for freedom, they certainly would. But they're told that their only chance for freedom is the gradual way that Gomulka is trying to bring it about. And so, many will heed the voice of reason and with heavy hearts vote for the list. But many others, after the misery and despair they've been through, are not disposed to reason, and they may vote their emotions. And if the vote turns out in all to be indecisive, it would tend to accentuate the conflicts already sharp within the Communist Party. Gomulka is having trouble keeping the conflicting wings of his party in line. Much of the zeal of last October, based on the courageous way Gomulka stood up to the Russians, has dissipated as he's been obliged to back and fill from October to this January. The situation is potentially explosive, and if Poland goes up in smoke, it could be much worse than Hungary. Poland has a population 3 times that of Hungary, a third of all the people in the satellite countries. With its industrial potential, it's much more important economically to Russia. Its position makes it much more vital from a military viewpoint. It's been said, but is worth now repeating, that Poland in 1957, like Poland in 1939, could provide the spark of a world war. But it should also be said that while the potential is there, an explosion is not likely. There are three important factors tending towards stability. One is Gomulka's personal popularity. The second, the position of the Catholic Church, which is supporting the elections, which can be expected to have a calming influence on this largely Catholic people. The third factor, or probable factor, is that the Russians are not really looking for trouble. They have avoided making an issue of anti-Soviet actions in Poland, such as the sacking of their consulate in Stettin. Russia probably does not want war any more than the West at this point. Poland today is not free, but there are stirrings of democracy. Voters have been told that, unlike 1952, they don't have to vote if they don't want to. And there is no sign that terror will be used as an instrument of election. I heard a professor tell a student's rally the other day, "We're only beginning to build democracy in this country. In the West, they've had it for 100 years or more, and are still learning. So give us a chance." That's the argument of democratic polls, urging the voters to support this imperfect communist regime. And what, ask many voters, is the alternative? This is Daniel Shore in Warsaw. Now back to Edward R. Murrow in New York.
That was the report of my colleague Daniel Shore on the parliamentary election that will be held in Poland this weekend. And according to his report, the Poles are finding, as other dictatorships have, that a little freedom is a dangerous thing. This is Ed Murrow. I'll be back in a moment with the world for today. Now, here is George Bryan.
On Monday, the attention of all America will be focused on Washington when President Eisenhower will take the oath of office for his second term. Of course, everyone can't be in Washington in person for the inauguration, but everyone can hear every detail of the ceremonies. Beginning with the inaugural parade from the White House to the Capitol, and continuing with the public swearing-in ceremonies, the President's all-important inaugural address, and ending with the parade back to the White House, CBS News microphones will be right on the scene. Then in the evening, CBS Radio will attend the two inaugural balls. Covering his seventh inaugural and heading the staff of ace CBS News reporters will be Robert Trout. Other on-the-spot reports will be given by Griffin Bancroft, Wells Church, Peter R. Clapper, George Herman, Alan Jackson, Louis Schollenberger, and Neil Strauss. Make sure you're tuned in to hear them bring you the inauguration Monday on CBS Radio. Now, here is Ed Murrow with the word for today.
Jules Verne wrote a book about a man who went around the world in 80 days. And now three stratojets have actually done it, nonstop in a little more than 45 hours. This shrinking of the world through speed recalls the observation of Willis Fisher. Men, he said, have learned to travel faster and faster, though on errands not conspicuously improved. This, I believe, is called progress. Good night and good luck.
You have been listening to Edward R. Murrow with the news. Mr. Murrow is heard Monday through Friday at this time with his report and analysis of the latest news developments. Mr. Murrow's is one of many authoritative broadcasts brought to you each day by CBS News. Later tonight, over many of these stations, you can find new illumination on various topics of current interest in a special hour of programming. One of the programs is So They Say, which will preview the Inauguration Day parade and reception with the help of those on the committee for the event. In a festive vein, Mrs. Charles Wilson, wife of the Defense Secretary, will have some fashion notes, and UNIVAC will do some weather predicting. On The World Tonight, with Blair Clark as narrator, there'll be a feature report from Los Angeles on the round-the-world flight of jet planes, a report from Monaco, where royalty is preparing for the birth of an heir, and a report from Kashmir on the current difficulties between India and Pakistan. Also included in this hour will be 5 minutes of news by Robert Trout and 5 minutes of news analysis by Eric Severide. This is the CBS Radio Network.